CIA 1964 to 1994.
I worked for the government for 35 years, starting with the Marine Corps from 1964 to 1968 with some service in Vietnam.
I was 25 years as a professional intelligence officer with CIA.
Almost 5 years in the Pentagon, and the last almost three of that working in the Office of Secretary of Defense.
Spent almost 20 years with the State Department, 3 years in Athens as a political counselor, the chief of the political section.
I'm a retired colonel in the United States Army, military intelligence, special forces.
I'm a former senior estimates officer with the Central Intelligence Agency.
I started actually as a science fellow at the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and became the chief scientist of the Arms Control Agency.
For 27 years was an analyst, first of Soviet affairs and then of wider responsibilities.
Well, I'm a congressman representing the 30th District in Los Angeles.
I've just completed almost three decades of service to the United States.
Most recently, I was an assistant secretary of defense in the Pentagon from 1994 to 2001.
I've served for 23 years in the American Foreign Service as a diplomat.
I worked for the CIA for 28 and a half years.
I joined the agency in 1988, originally with what was then known as the National Photographic Interpretation Center.
I'm Washington editor of The Nation magazine. I've been doing that for about 16 years now.
I'm the Labour MP for a constituency in Birmingham called Birmingham Lady Ward. I've been the MP for 20 years.
For 30 years, I was a diplomat serving my country abroad. My last position, however, was as ambassador to Saudi Arabia during the Gulf War.
In July of 1970, the president asked me to come over to be White House counsel. And I served for roughly 1,000 days until it all fell apart.
Spent 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army. I came back to public service in 2001 to be the Secretary of the Army.
Spent 21 years in the CIA. Of that time, I spent 90% in the Middle East.
I'm a former weapons inspector with the United Nations in Iraq. I served in that capacity from 1991 to 1998.
I worked for the CIA for 20 years, from 1966 to 1986.
I've worked on assessing secret nuclear weapons programs for almost 20 years.
Never expected that I'd leave the Navy and become the chief spook of our country, the director of Central Intelligence, but that happened.
Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
Iraq, weapons of mass destruction.
A clear threat to the United States.
And there's dozens of ballistic missiles.
It is sponsored and sheltered terrorists.
Paying suicide
bombers.
Chemical
weapons are equally chilling.
Biological weapons, including anthrax and botulism toxins.
Biological and chemical agent to kill millions of people.
Chemical weapons, including VX and sarin, mustard gas.
To a massive and sudden horror.
Massive death and destruction.
Death on a massive scale.
The danger to our country is grave. The danger to our country is growing. The Iraqi regime possesses biological and chemical weapons. The Iraqi regime is building the facilities necessary to make more biological and chemical weapons. And according to the British government, the Iraqi regime could launch a biological or chemical attack in as little as 45 minutes after the order were given. The regime has long-standing and continuing ties to terrorist organizations, and there are al-Qaeda terrorists inside Iraq. The regime is seeking a nuclear bomb, and with fissile material, could build one within a year.
The Bush administration made up its mind to go to war on September the 11th, 2001. From that time on, you were dealing with rationalization and justification for the war. You weren't dealing with real causes for the war or real reasons for the war. There was never a clear and present danger. There was never an imminent threat.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Weapons of mass death.
Weapons of mass destruction was a convenient way of tricking our Congress into giving the president authority to wage this war.
Saddam has resumed his efforts to acquire nuclear weapons.
Develop nuclear weapons.
Nuclear weapons.
Here the intelligence community did a pretty good job. I think for the most part they made it clear that the evidence was not there to show that Iraq was trying to reconstitute its nuclear capability, let alone whether or not it had a nuclear capability, which it didn't.
Leaders will use worst-case assessments that point to nuclear weapons to generate political support because they know people fear nuclear weapons so much.
The intelligence that we were operating off was correct.
The quality of our intelligence operation, I think we're better than anybody else.
We gathered a lot of intelligence.
Going to war based on intelligence is yet another example, I think, of intelligence simply not being able by nature, by definition, to live up to that kind of requirement. You may produce intelligence that could keep you out of a war, but I doubt that you'll ever get one, two, three reports of intelligence that will in any way allow you to go to war.
That intelligence was good, sound intelligence.
After the war, we have an internal review within the CIA conducted by a guy named Richard Kerr, who used to be the deputy director of the CIA. A CIA loyalist, enthusiast, and he at this point was telling reporters who bothered to ask that his initial findings were that the intelligence produced by the CIA was based on circumstantial, inferential evidence. They hadn't come up with any hard evidence since 1998 when the inspectors left, and that it always came with caveats and qualifiers.
There were pretty robust debates among the various people who gathered and assessed information, but that as somehow as it went up higher in the chain of command, finally reaching the White House, that there was a selective use of information to make their case.
I think this particular time, what has been very disturbing to my current colleagues, is the extent of massive intervention by people, particularly from Vice President Cheney's office and Vice President Cheney himself, in the process, and the very heavy leaning on the Director of Central Intelligence and his staff to produce precisely the language, let me say, which would allow them to make the statements that, which they have been making to support the decision to go into Iraq.
They call it data mining, going back over old information and coming with new conclusions. The whole purpose of the CIA was to leave those people out of Langley. That's why they're not in Washington. They're in Northern Virginia, away from the White House, away from Congress. Leave them alone, ask them what they think, but don't tell them to rethink their positions, because then you come up with nonsense, like we saw.
I think when you begin to distort the evidence, it leads you into some very dangerous rationale. And I think the administration has not been honest with what its longer-range goals and philosophy were.
But we now know that Saddam has resumed his efforts to acquire nuclear weapons. Among other sources, we've gotten this from firsthand testimony from defectors, including Saddam's own son-in-law.
His son-in-law's name was Hussein Kamel. It turned out that he also said that at his command, and he was in charge of the biochemical and nuclear weapons programs, at his command, all these things had been destroyed in 1991. And it wasn't really revealed until an enterprising British scholar went and got the debriefing report from Vienna and discovered that Kamel, highly touted Kamel, also said that at his command, and he was in command, they were destroyed.
Why was Hussein Kamel so cavalierly ignored, in essence, when he made his claims in 1995 that, you know, after I've given you the aflatoxin and the other anthrax-filled bombs and warheads, that's it. That's all that was left. Everything else is just the infrastructure for the program that we can restart once you guys go away.
Delay in decision and in action could lead to a massive and sudden horror.
It simply makes no sense to wait any longer.
Take action before it's too late.
We will not wait. As President Bush has said, time is not on our side.
I still thought that 3.5 months for new inspections was a rather short time before cooling day, and especially when we now see that they say, the U.S. government is saying that, look, you have to have a bit of patience, you know, these things take time.
preemptive war by its very nature is something that is entirely new to the United States of America and to what we call the old Western Alliance. You go back through history and at the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, a group of nations that had just killed most of each other off decided that this isn't quite the way to do it, and they came up with a set of laws that we've all lived with fairly well since then, which doesn't much allow for preemptive war.
I think the real reasons behind the Iraq War lie in a kind of philosophical and geopolitical vision of the neoconservatives who dominate our foreign policy establishment today. And that is the belief that the United States does dominate the world as the world's sole superpower, that it must assert its power globally, everywhere, and that anyone who resists this or defies American power is absolutely unacceptable and becomes automatically very much the enemy.
The theory that you can bludgeon political grievances out of existence doesn't have much of a track record. So essentially we have been neoconned into applying a school of thought about foreign affairs that has failed everywhere it's been tried.
So by the late 1990s, let alone 2003, it was clear that Iraq did not have a nuclear weapons program. But over and over again, President Bush, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, particularly Vice President Cheney, but also National Security Advisor Condi Rice, drummed up the idea of a reconstituted nuclear capability, and particularly the notion that I think has some resonance among the American people of the mushroom cloud.
For those who are advancing a different doctrine with which I strongly disagree, and that was that the United States could take unilateral preemptive action. But if you believe in unilateral preemptive action, it certainly has to be in response to an imminent threat. And the idea that Saddam Hussein could have nuclear weapons was a truly an imminent threat, and nothing more graphically pointed that out except the most powerful argument that was made: let's not let the smoking gun be a nuclear cloud.
If someone is waiting for a so-called smoking gun, it's certain that we will have waited too long.
We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud.
We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun. It could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
So a lot of people who supported the war in Iraq actually believed that Iraq had the capability to fire missiles that could reach the United States carrying payloads of nuclear or chemical or biological weapons. Iraq has never had the capability to do that. They didn't have it in the first Gulf War. They didn't have it in this war in Iraq. And they don't have it in any way of getting it in the future.
That very first day, on September 12th, one day after September 11th, the meeting that was held in the White House, in the Situation Room, led to Rumsfeld asking the question, shouldn't we use this as an opportunity to do something about Iraq as well?
There are Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Saddam Hussein cavorts with terrorists.
Secretly and without fingerprints, he could provide one of his hidden weapons to terrorists or help them develop their own.
Well, the war really had absolutely nothing to do with terrorism. There was no connection whatsoever between Iraq and the secular regime there and the religious fanatics who perpetrated 9/11.
Saddam was not a maniac or a fool. He was a terrible villain, yes, but he was not going to sacrifice his own life and the future of his country to stupid adventures with terrorists who had completely antithetical views to his.
It is just inconceivable to anybody who understands Saddam Hussein and understands the nature of highly centralized dictatorships generally that dictators would want to give up control of their most potent weaponry. Because once you've given up control, you have no control. So you can't say to Al-Qaeda, you will use this or you won't use it. The decision on whether or not they're going to use it depends on what Osama bin Laden does. Do you want to entrust your fate to Osama bin Laden and his nihilistic ways? I don't think so. Saddam Hussein is a psychopath and a sociopath. He was not an irrational being in the sense that he was going to ensure his own demise by doing something like that.
Al-Qaeda has had total contempt for Saddam Hussein himself. He's been a socialist. He's been very harsh. He's treated Islamic leaders, Islamist leaders, extremely harshly.
Iraq, and we have very good intelligence on this, was not part of the picture of terrorism before we invaded. Saddam Hussein and bin Laden were enemies. Bin Laden considered and said that Saddam Hussein was the socialist infidel. These were very different kinds of individuals competing for power in their own way, and Saddam Hussein made very sure that Al-Qaeda couldn't function in Iraq, that terrorists couldn't function, except for the small northeastern quadrant of the country where there was an extremist group, but he had no control over that. It was near the Iranian border.
There's no doubt that Ansar al-Islam is a radical Islamic terrorist group with ties to Al-Qaeda, but they operate in a part of Iraq that is not controlled by Hussein. The leaders say they seek to overthrow Hussein and his government.
They are our enemy. Well, really, they are also our enemy. We believe that Saddam Hussein, him and his group and his ministers also, they are outside of Islamist zone.
The ties with Al-Qaeda was just a scare tactic to exploit the trauma, the very real trauma that the American people have felt ever since 9/11, and to associate that trauma with Iraq. As you know from the polls, most Americans believed that Iraq had something to do with 9/11, and that was a very successful, very deliberate, and very unethical and immoral operation on the part of the PR people of this administration.
Every year, by law and by custom, we meet here to consider the State of the Union. This year we gather in this chamber deeply aware of decisive days that lie ahead.
Bush presented so many distorted beliefs, estimates, and guesstimates that he appears that he was misleading the public and the Congress.
From three Iraqi defectors, we know that Iraq in the late 1990s had several mobile biological weapons labs.
What we were working on before the war was a set of cartoons, of sketches, if you will, of what was said by a defector who probably had his own self-interest at heart and was willing to tell this government whatever he thought would get him the usual $1 million reward and a settlement with new name and a nice house somewhere.
Unfortunately, every reliable source of our own was unable to find anything convincing. So we were dependent on the defectors provided by Mr. Chalabi of the Iraqi National Congress. It's fascinating to see that he has been providing intelligence for many years, and every checkable piece of that intelligence that's come to public notice has proven to be false, at least self-serving in the extreme.
Saddam Hussein had the materials to produce as much as 500 tons of sarin, mustard, and VX nerve agent.
Any sarin that they were making in 1990, 1991 had a known shelf life of about 2 months. I have confirmed this with inspectors and analysts who were deeply involved in the 1990s analyses. Well, if you made it 12 years ago and it had a shelf life of 2 months, it may not be safe to drink, but it isn't sarin nerve gas any longer. And there's no way the agency could not have known that.
U.S. intelligence indicates that Saddam Hussein had upwards of 30,000 munitions capable of delivering chemical agents. Inspectors recently turned up 16 of them. Despite Iraq's recent declaration denying their existence.
And then they tried to use the fact that inspectors found 16 of these as evidence that thousands more existed. And again, I mean, it's, as a methodology, it's a very weak way to predict anything. And I think it borders on propaganda to argue that the small number that have been found by inspectors imply that, in this case, over 29,000 exist.
Saddam Hussein has not accounted for the remaining 29,984 of these prohibited munitions.
The Bush administration officials either routinely said or tried to give the impression that if Iraq had not fully accounted for all of a certain item related to chemical or biological weapons, then it must be there. And that's not at all what the inspector said or found.
He hasn't accounted for that material. He's given no evidence that he has destroyed it.
And the inspectors could go in and say, okay, we can prove, yeah, you destroyed that set in this way or that set in that way, but these others, we can't prove it. And that doesn't mean that they didn't destroy these warheads or whatever the item was. It just means Iraq hadn't been able to prove it.
Saddam Hussein had material sufficient to produce more than 38,000 liters of botulinum toxin, enough to subject millions of people to death by respiratory failure.
The inspectors had evidence to say that Iraq had not fully revealed its biological weapons program, particularly its ability to make botulinum toxin, and therefore it was an open issue. But again, it doesn't mean that what the inspectors found was evidence that Iraq possessed that.
Our intelligence sources tell us that he has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes suitable for nuclear weapons production.
I think there was very little doubt that the centrifuge tubes, so-called, were nothing but rocket motor tubes to go into M81-style artillery rockets. They certainly have all the specs for that.
Nuclear experts, for instance, from Lawrence Livermore's laboratory's Z Division, the experts on centrifuge enrichment, came out and said, no, you couldn't enrich uranium using these tubes. They're not compatible.
I saw it as a deliberate attempt to take information and selectively take information and try to basically say Iraq poses an imminent nuclear threat and therefore action is absolutely necessary. And I felt that was absolutely wrong.
The International Atomic Energy Agency confirmed in the 1990s that Saddam Hussein had an advanced nuclear weapons development program.
The administration showed photos of nuclear or former nuclear weapons sites in Iraq, pre-1991 nuclear weapons sites, claimed that new construction showed they were ongoing nuclear weapons production sites. Complete nonsense.
Before the war in Iraq, the United Nations inspectors told us that Saddam Hussein did not have nuclear weapons capability. It turns out that's true.
The most troubling thing about the fact of the distortions and the misleading statements that Bush gave Congress is that it is a federal felony. It's a crime to mislead and distort information and present it to the Congress.
The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa.
8 days later, when Secretary Powell addressed the UN about weapons of mass destruction, he deliberately left out any reference to attempts to buy uranium from Africa.
I didn't use the uranium at that point because I didn't think that was sufficiently strong as evidence to present before the world.
CIA officials warned members of the president's staff the intelligence was not good enough to make the statement, Iraq tried to buy uranium from Africa.
In October, for the Cincinnati speech, not for the State of the Union, but the Cincinnati speech, George Tenet asked that this be taken out of the Cincinnati speech, the reference to Yellowcake. It was taken out of the Cincinnati speech because whenever the director of Central Intelligence wants something out, it's gone.
How to get back in?
It's not a matter of getting back in. It's a matter, Tim, that 3+ months later, people didn't remember that George Tenet had asked that it be taken out of Cincinnati speech and cleared the agency.
First of all, it should be noted that Colin Powell's speech to the United Nations was theater, a masterful theater, effective theater at the time. Here's a man who has tremendous credibility, who presents himself to the Security Council, to the American people, to the international public, and stares the camera in the eye and says he knows Iraq has weapons of mass destruction.
Leaving Saddam Hussein in possession of weapons of mass destruction for a few more months or years is not an option.
My first visual impression here
watching George Tenet, the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, back there as a prop, almost like a potted plant, as if to say that the Central Intelligence Agency stands behind, or in this case sits behind, everything that Colin Powell says. That was a terrific blow to the morale of the Central Intelligence Agency analysts.
Saddam Hussein has chemical weapons.
Chemical weapons, although they can be very deadly in a subway station or something like this, are not really strategic weapons. They are weapons that can kill 50, 100, 200 people, but in fact they won't devastate you the way a nuclear weapon in New York City or Chicago or someplace would be a deadly blow.
Saddam Hussein has used these horrific weapons on another country and on his own people.
He used weapons, Saddam Hussein did, back in the 1980s, when the U.S. administration, the Reagan administration, was actually supporting him and allowing him to import the chemical precursors for that. Donald Rumsfeld, actually, as a special envoy for Ronald Reagan back in those years, helped, you know, open the door for better relations between Washington and Baghdad.
Colin Powell spoke of thousands of liters of anthrax that were unaccounted for, and he said they're probably hiding it. And then he held up a little vial of white powder. And he said, a couple teaspoonfuls of white powder like this, if launched against American cities, could kill thousands of Americans. If he was truly to reflect the Iraqi capability, he would have held up a bottle of Diet Coke and said, the Iraqis produced anthrax that looked like this. It has a shelf life of 3 years. The last known production batch came out in 1991. So even if Iraq was hiding this brown sludge liquid, it would be useless today.
Just a few weeks ago, we intercepted communications between two commanders in Iraq's 2nd Republican Guard Corps.
If you know anything about Iraq, they have very strict communication security procedures. So you would never have military personnel speaking in the clear over a radio about sensitive subjects.
On the left is a close-up of one of the four chemical bunkers.
There were never any chemical weapons in that facility. I'm intimately familiar with that facility. I've inspected it a number of times. Other inspectors have inspected it many more times than I have.
To believe they were proof is to believe the statement that Iraq would put its crown jewels in the one building or one of the few buildings that either the United States will bomb first or the inspectors will go to first.
The truck you also see is a signature item. It's a decontamination vehicle.
The UN weapons inspectors knew that the trucks shown by Colin Powell in those photographs were fire trucks, not decontamination trucks.
I would have to comment here on Secretary of State Colin Powell's debut as an imagery analyst. It was highly embarrassing for those of us who know something about the business. We couldn't tell whether this was an honest mistake by those who now do the imagery analysis, who now report to the Secretary of Defense, unlike our day when they reported to the Central Intelligence Agency, whether that was the case or whether perhaps Colin Powell was being set up.
From our point of view, I mean, we do all kinds of analysis of satellite imagery. You can't form any conclusions on what's going on inside the building. They could have been building tractors. They could have been doing nothing inside that facility.
Now look at the picture on the right. You are now looking at two of those sanitized bunkers. The signature vehicles are gone. It's been cleaned up. And it was done on the 22nd of December as the UN inspection team is arriving.
Vehicles, they rotate from site to site. And so the absence of the vehicle on the second photo, which we know is the 22nd of December, could just as easily be explained by the normal rotation, because you didn't tell us the date of the first, and it was several weeks before.
We have noted that the two satellite images of the site were taken several weeks apart. The reported movement of munitions at the site could just as easily have been a routine activity as a movement of prescribed munitions in anticipation of imminent inspection.
We have first-hand descriptions of biological weapons factories on wheels and on rails.
These mobile labs have now been shown to be nothing more than hydrogen generation facilities.
Here you see both truck and rail car mounted mobile factories.
When you take a look at the mobile labs that Colin Powell discussed, he didn't put up photographs of these facilities. He put up artist renditions of these facilities. Why? Because we have no proof they exist.
This video of an Iraqi test flight obtained by UNSCOM some years ago shows an Iraqi F-1 Mirage jet aircraft. Note the spray coming from beneath the Mirage. That is 2,000 liters of simulated anthrax. Iraqis continue to visit bin Laden in his new home in Afghanistan.
George Tenet's analysts had spent a year and a half of torturous investigation, torturous analysis, to see if there were ties between al-Qaeda and Iraq. They found none.
Our conservative estimate is that Iraq today has a stockpile of between 100 and 500 tons of chemical weapons agent.
So the Secretary of State is telling us that our conservative estimate is that Iraq possesses between 100 and 500 tons of chemical weapons agent, enough to fill 16,000 warheads on the battlefield. Where are they? What happened to them? My suspicion is that this is not our conservative estimate, that this sounds very much to me like our neoconservative estimate.
Iraqi denials of supporting terrorism take their place alongside the other Iraqi denials of weapons of mass destruction. It is all a web of lies.
It was a masterful performance, but none of it was true. Where are all these weapons? Where is all this VX? Where is all the anthrax?
The reality is that between the original UNSCOM inspections and the UNMOVIC inspections, you destroyed, with those inspections, 90 to probably 95% of the Iraqi arsenal. The first Gulf War destroyed almost nothing. And, you know, post-war U.S. battle damage assessments confirm that.
By 1998 at the latest, those inspectors had discovered most of the weapons of mass destruction, and the Iraqi programs at that point were essentially at an end.
The inspection regime worked. It was the most intrusive inspection regime in history, and it worked. And at the end of the day, that's another reason why we went to war for nothing.
No doubt in my mind, but that they currently have chemical and biological weapons.
The Iraqi regime possesses biological and chemical weapons.
We know for a fact that there are weapons there.
Found the weapons of mass destruction. We found biological laboratories.
Everybody knows that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
I have every reason to believe that the intelligence that we were operating off was correct.
No question, we have said that Saddam Hussein possesses biological and chemical weapons.
We know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad and east, west, south, and north somewhat.
And all this will be made clear in the course of the operation for whatever duration it takes.
And are you confident that you'll also find weapons of mass destruction?
I believe we will find evidence of the programs of chemical and biological weapons, yes.
How about the actual weapons?
Well, I just don't know. Let's wait and see what the team is.
Inspections continue with our new exploitation teams that have been brought in.
And that we will in fact find weapons or evidence of weapons programs that are conclusive.
It is somewhat puzzling, I think, that you can have 100% certainty about the weapons of mass destruction's existence and zero certainty about where they are.
Do you agree? And does it matter whether or not
we might ask the Prime Minister that won't be.
This is a process that takes some time, and it will ebb and flow.
One thing we know is that he had a weapons program.
I don't know anybody
that I can think of who has contended that the Iraqis had nuclear weapons.
And we believe he has, in fact, reconstituted nuclear weapons.
But on the specific issue of weapons of mass destruction, it's going to take time, and we're going to have to be patient.
Over time, the truth will come out.
Now, it's going to take time to find anything because they've had...
People will find that we presented a solid case, a case that is there and was there and will remain there.
So it's going to take a period of time to find the people. I don't think we'll discover anything myself.
I believe that we will find the truth. And the truth is he was developing a program for weapons of mass destruction.
I think what will happen is we'll discover people who will tell us where to go find it.
You're not going
to
find it simply in a house-to-house search. You're going to find it when people start to talk to you.
It is not like a treasure hunt where you just run around looking everywhere hoping you find something. I just don't think that's going to happen. The inspectors didn't find anything, and I doubt we will.
Our people are going to find out the truth, and the truth will say that this intelligence is good intelligence, no doubt in my mind.
What we will do is find the people who will tell us. There are a lot of people who lie and get away with it. And that's just a fact.
Is U.S. credibility on the line over weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
I'm not exactly sure what that means.
We're being told now that there's no way that we're going to be told what it's going to cost until after you have begun military action.
It depends on the assumptions. It depends on how long the war lasts. It depends on whether weapons of mass destruction are used.
What we have done is we have taken estimates looking at different variables and said, if this were the case on this variable and then on this variable, but there's so many variables that the numbers of possible point answers create a range that simply isn't useful.
Yeah, I'm just not going to get into any speculation about numbers.
We're dealing with a country that can really finance its own reconstruction and relatively soon.
So the money's going to come from Iraqi oil revenue, as everyone has said. They think it's going to be something like $2 billion this year. They think it might be something like 15, 12 next year. They think it might be something like 18 to 20 plus the next 19. The next year.
I will soon submit to Congress a request for $87 billion.
Why did the administration so dramatically underestimate the cost of this war?
We did not have perfect foresight into what we were going to find in Iraq.
Just 16 words in the State of the Union address, words that we now know were misleading. Had retired career diplomat Joe Wilson tried to warn the administration of just that nearly a year before the speech.
I received a call from the CIA. In February 2000, just invited out to talk to those people within the broader intelligence community who deal with three different subjects, Iraq, uranium, and Niger. I briefed them on what I knew about the uranium business. It was during the course of that briefing that they said that they had received a report that had piqued the interest of the Office of the Vice President, and that report was of a purported memorandum of agreement authorizing the sale of uranium yellowcake, somewhat enriched uranium, from Niger to Iraq. And it was a document that was executed by the government of Niger. They asked me if I would be willing to go out and take another look at it and talk to people I knew there. I left there telling them that if they wanted, I would be able to free up my schedule. They subsequently called me and said, please do. I spent the 8 days there drinking mint tea and talking to everybody there was to talk to who knew anything about the subject matter in Niamey. And I'd come back persuaded that could not have happened. One, from a business perspective, because of the way the consortium was structured, you just couldn't do it without a lot of people knowing. And two, the way the government bureaucracy was structured, you could not make the decision without a lot of people knowing. And if you made the decision would be reflected in a series of signatures on the documents. And if the documents did not contain those signatures, they could not be authentic government of Niger documents.
The president quoted a British paper. We did not know at the time. No one knew at the time in our circles. Maybe someone knew down in the bowels of the agency, but no one in our circles knew that there were doubts and suspicions that this might be a forgery. Of course, it was information that was mistaken.
Now, given what I knew about where the question had originated, and given what I knew about the way the government works, I knew that people in her circle did know.
Based on thorough analysis, the IA has concluded, with the concurrence of outside experts, that these documents, which form the basis for the reports of recent uranium transactions between Iraq and Niger, are in fact not authentic.
Numerous French words were misspelled in the documents. One of the letters was signed by a Niger official who had left office 10 years ago. Several dates in the documents did not match the day of the week. Several of the names and titles of officials mentioned in the documents were incorrect.
We all know that the documentation on Yellow Cake from Niger was fake, but why doesn't anybody say who did it? Who faked the document? And why don't we take another look then at the same stream of consciousness that was prevailing at that moment on the aluminum tubes and even the trailers, the bioweapons trailers that were so ballyhooed. At that point, someone's got to say, who is putting this intelligence out there and why? And I don't think that question's been answered, and maybe because the answer is known, and it's not a pleasant one.
Who was it that asked for this review of the Niger nuclear material question? It was the vice president. Mr. Wilson, former ambassador, was sent to Niger in response to the vice president's questions about this issue. So assumedly, the vice president got a report back in response to his question, and that report contained the Wilson memo of his assessment of the situation.
The question remains, who did the document? Who forged the document? And why? The list is possibly short. Somebody ought to be able to work on that.
Wilson says his family is the subject of a smear campaign by senior administration officials. They deliberately leaked his wife's identity as a covert CIA operative, damaging her future career and compromising past missions, after he criticized the administration on Meet the Press and in the New York Times.
The White House hatchet men came out and started writing articles in which they basically said that Wilson, the first one came out and said that Wilson told the truth because he's a Democrat. Set that up as an argument. Democrats tell the truth. Ergo, Republicans fill in the blank. Then a couple of senior administration officials leaked to Bob Novak that my wife was a CIA operative involved in the weapons of mass destruction business at the CIA.
Senior administration officials is a key to being very, typically the president, vice president, cabinet officers, and the top of the White House had gone out of their way to get that information out. Not only told Novak, told Time magazine, they wanted that information out. Now, that's a statutory law that prohibits the identification of CIA operatives.
What you're doing when you expose a CIA officer of any name, you're basically taking their entire career and flushing it down the toilet.
Also has the potential of placing that person in jeopardy because of their operations, and their own operations and people they have operated with in jeopardy. So it was a very vengeful act against the ambassador to try to hurt him by hurting his wife's career, if not wishing for physical damage. I had never seen a dirty trick. It could be a hit.
A president of the United States and an administration who has come to office on a platform of restoring dignity and honor to the White House. What they did was neither dignified nor was it terribly honorable. Was it germane to the issue at hand?
It is fair to say that the Iraq war was a diversion from the war on terrorism. It certainly meant that people weren't paying as much attention to Afghanistan as they should have, and the resources that might have gone to Afghanistan ended up being focused more on Iraq.
If you attack another country with no justification, people are going to say, wait a minute, this isn't a war on terrorism. This is a war on, this is imperialism. This is colonialism, you know. This is why it's a distraction, because you need the help of these people. If you get this view that the CIA and the FBI are lurking around the bazaars and the souks of the Middle East and handcuffing people or assassinating, that's not the way the world works. You've got to have the help of the locals to identify these people and either put them in jail or remove them from positions where they can do harm.
In January 2002, as I was sitting in the bunker of the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan, and I and several colleagues were sitting around the one little working TV, and lo and behold, here came the statement of the axis of evil, you know, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. And we looked at ourselves, and, oh my God, here we are kind of in ground zero of Afghanistan. And while talking in very belligerent terms about these other three countries, and we don't have Afghanistan either.
The only person Saddam was a threat to at this point, as we saw when the army collapsed, was to Iraq. He didn't have weapons of mass destruction. He wasn't scaring anybody. He certainly wasn't scaring the Iranians or the Turks or the Saudis or anybody else. It was a state that was on the verge of failure. Now it is a failed state. Failed states cause terrorism. You know, you can name them. Afghanistan, Lebanon, Somalia. Anytime you create a vacuum, it's where people flock to or discontented to fight wars.
The only real connection is that having invaded Iraq, we are very likely to get a focus of terrorism. We are likely to produce what the president has said Iraq represents, namely the central battlefield in the war on terrorism. Why? Because we've sent a lot of Americans into a place where they're sitting ducks for people who think the only good American is a dead one.
Twenty-two people were killed in the attack. About an hour ago, a massive car bomb ripped out the corner of a building here, and the casualties are still coming out.
Iraq cannot be governed by Americans. I don't care what the intention is. I don't care if we truly want to build a democracy there. It cannot be ruled by a foreign power.
We, as the one indispensable nation of the world, as we characterized ourselves for so long in the last administration, cannot contemplate that possibly someone else might not like everything we call the American way of life, and that they would, in fact, welcome us into their countries. This may not be the case.
The only tool in the toolbox of the Bush administration is military force. Military force is a very blunt instrument. It just doesn't work. We've created more terrorists in Iraq, and we haven't even solved the problem in Afghanistan.
One of the more ironic effects of the attack on Iraq was to buttress other countries in the conviction of the infamous remark by an Indian general after the first Gulf War, when he said the lesson of this war is that if you have to fight the United States, you better have nuclear weapons.
In some respects, it's as if Vietnam didn't even happen. It's as if a lot of our leaders have suffered some kind of historical and political lobotomy. And that's frightening. And every American should be concerned about that, because the United States ultimately is supposed to be an exemplar for the rest of the world. We are supposed to be, in Ronald Reagan's words, that shining city on a hill. Well, that shining city is looking kind of slummy right now in terms of our image abroad, and I think with good reason. We've violated, I think, fundamental principles that have guided this country's foreign policy so successfully since 1947.
You don't want your president to be seen as a hot dog. And when your president gets into a jumpsuit and gets in the back of a jet and lands on an aircraft carrier and then waddles out with his little straps between his legs, and that's not, I mean, you want a sign of kind of maturity and not testosterone blasting through when you're talking about things so fundamentally important as sending a nation to war and sending young men and women to their deaths.
There is a sense in Washington now that you can't raise objections to this because you're not supporting troops in the field. I would rapidly point out that unlike almost anybody I know that holds office in this country, I've had two sons in uniform, both of whom have been in combat, and so I don't have to take any nonsense from anybody, nor will I.
Mark Twain's definition of patriotism is patriotism is supporting your country all the time and your government when it deserves it.
Well, I don't think it's patriotic to stand by and remain silent while your country stumbles into disaster.
Patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels, and I think these are scoundrels. They have no argument now. They have no defense for what they did. The country is in a terrible international security situation that I think is perilous. So they're attacking the patriotism of others.
Having been an insider, I know that the insiders don't have it all right. They make mistakes, and indeed, it's more likely to be mistakes, and it's more likely to be misjudgment if there is no criticism.
It was Jefferson who said that our kind of government is not based on trust. It's based on, in fact, suspicion.
Supporting the Constitution, understanding what's in the Constitution, caring about the Constitution. That's why we don't have a king, because we have a piece of paper. So I think that is patriotism.
It's not just those of us who've been privileged to serve actually in the government who are the patriots. It's every citizen who respects and honors the fact that we have such a wonderful country.
To suggest that if you have a different viewpoint than any given administration, and or if you're not supporting the president in policies that may be highly erroneous, I don't see that as patriotism at all. In fact, I would argue that any patriot with integrity is going to speak out if he or she feels that that we're on the wrong course.
It's not unpatriotic to demand that Congress upholds its constitutional responsibilities regarding the declaration of war. It's not unpatriotic to be very upset, vocally upset, when Congress abrogates this constitutional responsibility by transferring war powers authority to the President of the United States, as they did in October of 2002.
Now listen, when you guys were working NASDAQ and the dot-coms, I was out in Iraq trying to get rid of Saddam and almost got killed for it. And besides almost going to jail. So it doesn't take a whole lot of courage for me to come out against the war, and I did at the beginning, but I was studiously ignored.
When we did the first Gulf War, when I came out of Baghdad in 1991, I met with the President of the United States, I met with the senior leadership of both parties, and the one thing that sticks with me to this day is the extent to which each one of them explained to me in very emotional terms the extent to which they had to plumb their consciences to come to a decision on how to vote on the use of force authorization. It had been a moral decision on their part. It had been one that had kept them up at night as they thought their way through this. We owe our soldiers, our sailors, our airmen, and our Marines nothing less before we send them to battle.
Sometimes the true patriot takes the unpopular course, but helps their country avoid mistakes. And even if they can't persuade, at least they tried.
For me, America is this amazing land of opportunity, of beauty, of idealism, of hope. It is a beacon to the world. It's a place of fantastic people. And what infuriates me more than anything else is that this administration has systematically slandered, libeled, blackened the image of America to our friends and allies around the world.
Having the authority and the ability to go and wage war is a very, very solemn thing, and it needs to be done with care and liberation and with genuine forethought. And I think that none of that was present in the lead up to this entire debacle that we now call enduring freedom.
When the emperor has no clothes, you have to have the presence of mind and the courage to stand up and say, the emperor has no clothes.
Yeah, let me comment on that. I'm not so sure that the United States is going around the world and say, this is the way it's got to be. We can help. And maybe it's just our difference in government, the way we view government. I mean, I want to empower people. I don't, you know, I want to help people help themselves, not have government tell people what to do. So I'm not exactly sure where the vice president's coming from, but I think one way for us to end up being viewed as the ugly American is for us to go around the world saying, we do it this way, so should you. Now, we trust freedom. We know freedom is a powerful, powerful, a powerful force, much bigger than the United States of America, as we saw recently in the Balkans. But maybe I misunderstand where you're coming from, Mr. Vice President, but I think the United States must be humble and must be proud and confident of our values, but humble in how we treat nations that are figuring out how to chart their own course.